Just text me.
Blog Talk Radio.
Is the song playing?
You are listening to Dr. Guy Gumbo Talk with your host, Dr. Tanisha Guy, and her co-hosts, Steve J. and marriage and family therapist expert, Fatima. This show is not intended to be therapy, but the sole purpose is encourage dialogue across ages, gender, religious backgrounds, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. Feel free to join in the discussion. We want to hear what you think. And don't forget to tell friends about Dr. Guy Gumbo Talk.
Hello?
Hello? Hello. Hey, Fatima, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dr. Guy's Gumbo Talk. I am so glad that you guys have decided to tune in this Sunday. Before we go ahead and get started with our topic today, because this is a topic that I am really interested in hearing more about, I just want to remind you guys about the announcement that I made last week about the census and how important it is to get that census filled out. You guys, if you haven't already, should be getting an email if you're going to fill that information out online, and it will provide you with a code so that you can complete the census online. And so we do know how important it is to complete that document or that form, so please take time when you guys receive it to update. I think it's 5 or 7 questions. It's really short. So if you have time this week, if it comes, please fill it out as soon as you get it. So I did want to just remind everyone about that. And so as always, I want to introduce my co-host. Hey, Steve.
Hey. I'm over here sitting on rolls and rolls of toilet paper.
Shut up. Hey,
Fatima. Hello, Dr. Guy. I am not sitting on rolls of toilet paper, but I am very excited and ready for this topic today.
Perfect. So last week we talked about the coronavirus, COVID-19, and after the show, I got a lot of good feedback from people saying how helpful the information was. And, you guys, that was only a week ago, but I feel like it was weeks ago when we just talked about that topic and how so many things have changed in so many cities in just the last 7 days. And so We're all in different locations, and, you know, our states and cities are doing different things right now. And so I do just want to remind everyone universally about social responsibility and social distancing and how important that is. And so it seems like sometimes people are calling the social distancing isolation. And within the last week, people seem to already have cabin fever. And so it's not isolation, right? Like, they're not pushing people to isolate themselves unless, obviously, they have tested positive for the virus. But they are encouraging people to be socially responsible. And so, you know, if you do have to go out in public, keep your distance as far as possible. And if you are, you know, in your home, that doesn't mean you have to isolate and be by yourself. So just remember, this doesn't mean that you cannot be around anyone at all. It just means kind of be responsible. And everyone should really be treating themselves like they have the virus at this point, because we don't know yet. And so we want to try to keep everyone as safe as possible. And so, Fatima, Steve, anything that you guys want to mention about coronavirus or safety concerns or anything like that before we move into our topic today?
I think you've covered it as far as safety concerns. I do want to mention, because I talked about the campaign that I'm managing, and to let people know that Governor Abbott has postponed the runoff primary election until July 14th. So definitely I want to get that information out there. So if people are listening, also, if anyone has an opportunity, you can go to like her Facebook page. It's Sandra Linson Bell, because there we'll keep things updated and information and stuff that, you know, we're planning once get out of quarantine. But we have some things that we're planning and it's going on, an opportunity to win tickets to a Cowboys game for all those Cowboys fans, and some other things that we're planning. So you can like her Facebook page or her Instagram page to make sure that you are in the loop on what we're doing as far as that's concerned.
Okay, great. Thanks for that update. I was going to ask you about that. And the other thing, like, I don't know how this slipped my mind as a therapist, but I do want to also remind our listeners about the importance of mental health and how during these particular times, even though we have been talking a lot about people keeping themselves physically healthy, your mental and emotional health really tie in and they go hand in hand. And so during times like this, when, you know, there are just these unknowns and there's a lot of fear that's just kind of running rampant as we see these numbers increase, because now states are able to provide testing. I do want to remind people that as we talk about, you know, making sure that you remain physically healthy, if you don't take care of your mental state of being, that will weaken or has the capacity to weaken your immune system. And so people, you know, levels of anxieties will rise. People will begin to report levels of depression, obviously, because people are losing their jobs and they can't pay their bills. And so those are some things to take into consideration. And so really make sure that you are trying as best as possible to maintain your mental state as well, because you don't want that to weaken your immune system to make you more susceptible to catching, you know, the cold or whatever potentially these other concerns are that we have. And so if you are in a state where like California, New York, Connecticut, and I'm missing one, there are four states, I think New York, California, Connecticut, and Illinois. If you are in one of those states where you guys have been ordered to stay at home unless you are leaving for, you know, necessity purposes, in those states, those individuals really do have to be mindful about, again, how to take care of their mental health and practice things like mindfulness. You know, when you find that your mind is wandering off about the what ifs and the possibilities of what could happen, then you want to try to refocus and center yourself so that you can try to keep your mind at peace and still. And some people are like, I don't know how to do that. And there's so many ways that you can do those things. If you don't meditate, or if you're not familiar with mindfulness, there are so many helpful tools out there now, especially with so many people not being able to leave. People are doing things on live Facebook to talk about how do you kind of get centered and tune in to self and kind of block out all these external noises. And so I really do want to stress the importance of that because they all do go hand in hand. So with that being said, I do want to go ahead and jump into our topic today. And so today we are going to look at can the modern-day couple find a way to have it all? And so we talk about this in conversations with people. And if you're – this is a question that I definitely am going to have for our guests because we have a couple that's going to be coming up shortly. And for team of you and Steve is that people talk about, you know, can you have it all? Can you be in a successful relationship? And can you also have a successful career, or do you have to choose? And in some of our previous shows, Fatima, I think you and I have kind of talked about where we feel personally that society may make it more challenging for women to pursue their careers and to pursue their families, and they're kind of penalized in the workforce. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. Can modern-day couples find a way to have it all? So, Fatima, I am going to toss it over to you, and you can bring on our two wonderful guests today that are going to join in on our discussion.
Okay. So I'm gonna start first with saying I've mentioned before on the show how I love the show Married at First Sight. Our couple did not meet on Married at First Sight. But I'm bringing that up because on the most recent episode, one of the couples, a young woman, Katie, was into it with her husband because he was sharing his dreams with her. And, I mean, his dreams aren't necessarily that crazy. Like, he wants to go, I think, like, rock climbing, and he wants to write a Christmas song, and he wants to write a book, and he wants to travel. And that was an affront to her because she felt like having those kind of dreams aren't things that you can have as a married man. In fact, she thought that he was being completely unrealistic and that he was acting like a boy and not a man. Those are her words. And I found that a little disturbing. And he mentioned in the show that he was concerned that she couldn't dream with him. And the reason I'm referencing that situation is because one of the things that I love about this couple I'm going to introduce is that when I see them, I see two people who support one another's dreams. And I see two people who not only support each other's dreams, but they dream together and they dream big. John Gottman, he considers the masters of marriage people who avoid what he calls the four horsemen of the apocalypse in their relationship. And those, the four horsemen are criticism, contempt, stonewalling, and defensiveness. And when I look at the interactions of Jason and Shanti, I see two people who appear to be masters of marriage because they don't seem to have those four horsemen in their marriage. So a little bit about them. Jason, I mean, if we're going to talk about power couples, this is, in my opinion, they are it. Jason is, he's an entrepreneur. He is the only Black owner of a coffee roasting company in the state of Missouri. They live in St. Louis. In fact, he might be one of only three in the country. He owns Northwest Coffee Roasting Company. If you happen to be in St. Louis, I highly recommend stopping by. And as a matter of fact, they also have food, and the food is fantastic. He's also the first Black person elected to the Clayton School Board. And if anyone knows anything about the Clayton District, it's pretty exclusive. So that was a very huge deal. Shanti, in her own right, she is not only a tenured professor at the Washington University in St. Louis, but she is the first Black woman who moved from associate to tenured professor in the School of Arts and Sciences. I'm sorry, she moved from assistant to tenured professor in the School of Arts and Sciences, which is the largest school at Washington University. Her specialty is politics and understanding infectious diseases, specifically HIV. She's a medical anthropologist. And she looks at like the political, social, and cultural aspect of how illness impacts all of those different areas. So without any further ado, I'm going to let them jump in here. They are an incredibly fascinating couple. They're the parents to two amazing little boys, or young men. So Shanti and Jason, welcome to the show. And actually, I'd ask you guys if you could start with telling us how long you've been married and how you met.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear us?
Yes.
Hey,
hello,
hey.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay,
hey,
thank you for that fabulous introduction.
Absolutely.
Glad to join us.
The truth isn't hard to tell.
Well, we're delighted and honored to be on and to engage in this conversation. So I'll let Jim, how long have we been married? 13, 14 years?
Since 2006. So it's what, 14 years?
14 years.
Yeah, 14 years this year, I believe. And, we've been, when you're in the marriage, I don't know if I feel the same way about how you describe things. But I do think we have a fantastic relationship.
It's a lot of work being a Black couple in America, trying to raise two Black kids. Raising Black boys has different issues than raising Black girls. Supporting a Black entrepreneur in a predominantly white city that is known for being extremely racist. You know, we're right near Ferguson, so it has that sort of history. But it does take working together as a team,
Yeah, it's stressful.
It is. It's a lot. But we managed to get through it. I think sometimes the hard times and the obstacles brings us closer together as a family because we know in order to advance, we have to be there to support each other.
Yeah, I think the difficulties of navigating this community up here in St. Louis and really the community at large grounds your that kind of contempt for your partner when you know that the ills of our community affect us directly, like it affects anybody else. So it just having that good relationship, being able to stay grounded, stay focused, and knowing that you know what you think, what you see, and what you read about through your in college, but in business or whatever, what you see your friends allegedly doing is not really always the reality. And Black folks still have a lot to do in terms of growth and positioning themselves in our community, as a middle class and upper middle class. So yeah, it's a lot of work.
Well, I just want to say thank you both for joining us today. And Fatima, thank you so much for inviting them to come on the show. And last week we were actually supposed to do this show, but in light of the coronavirus and so many things that were happening last week, we decided to postpone this show so that we could talk about COVID-19 last week. And you guys were able to come back to the show this week. And so I do want to say thank you for that. For being flexible with us. And so I have a host of questions that I want to ask the two of you guys, and I'm sure Steve will probably chime in, and obviously Fatima, You know them. And so definitely feel free to chime in with the questions. But one of the things that I guess I want to ask you guys is, when we talk about relationships, in particular for African Americans, one of the things that we know statistics-wise is that our numbers of marriage rates are going down, right? Where even though across the board marriages, the numbers have decreased, but they're even the numbers are even smaller for African Americans. And so you guys have been together for 14 years, married for 14 years, and you're raising two sons, and you both have careers. And so for people that are listening, what would you say has grounded the two of you guys in being able to do this? Because people say how challenging it is. They either feel like they have to choose their career, or I'm going to choose the relationship, which means my career now is going to suffer. So what are some of the things that you guys have been able to do to kind of find some balance?
Yeah, what do you think?
You know, I think the main thing is not expecting more from your family, whether it's your partner or your kids, keeping your expectations realistic, that it is both of you have to give 100%, both of you have to pull your weight, you have to come to the door of your house knowing that the stresses that went on at work, you can't let it, you know, you are going to be irritable, because I think as Black people in the workforce, there are a lot, there are extra stressors on us, and you just have to be mindful that when you step in that front door, to not take out those stressors on your family at home, and if you do, to just take a deep breath. And not expect, you know, make sure that we're putting realistic expectations on our partners. I know I always, my friends who aren't married, I think they sometimes forget that you don't have to look for your partner for complete, you know, you need to make yourself happy before you, before other people can make you happy. And, you know, Jason makes me happy, but it's because I'm first happy with who I am. And it's a give and take. You're not always going to have your way. And as a, you know, woman with a PhD, I have a lot of opinions, a lot of attitude, a lot of like opinions. And Jason has a lot of opinions, and knowing that we have to compromise a lot, or we have to listen to the other person, is really important. And knowing that you might not agree all the time on an approach, but certainly a team decision, we know from tons of experience, is always better than one person making it individually. And it might take more time to make a decision, but a group decision that's well thought out is going to serve the family unit the best. I mean, I think respecting each other is always important out in public, in front of the kids.
Jay, what do you think?
It's supporting each other.
Yeah, I think Shanti described it well. I think it's, you know, checking our bags at the door before we enter the home, and not placing unrealistic expectations on your partner. And then also the other thing is like when you achieve the goals of like what allegedly makes you a star in your society, right? So Shanti, the PhD professor, Yale graduate, PhD from Yale, you know, and I'm a, you know, Washington University graduate from business school, and I own a coffee company. Like, that sounds really cool on paper, but you can't let that really affect, you can't really affect, like, the realities of where you are in life. And the struggles that you still have, and how it can put a toll on your marriage if you allow it to, you know, I guess become more important than than the reality of, you still got to put in the work, you're still gonna have those struggles, you still may not have gotten, you know, achieved your goals and gotten where you wanted to get, you know, so Yeah, I think that's it's just a matter of just like, you know, just checking the luggage at the door and making sure you all are on the same page when it comes to what's most important in your marriage. One thing about us is that the one thing I would say we argue about, if you were to ask that question, it would be style on how we get the kids, our kids motivated to do their academic studies. So
uh-huh.
like Shanti and I will, Shanti's a writer, and I respect Shanti, and I've always thought Shanti was the best writer that I've met. But then again, I have a more gangster style to the approach of getting my kids to get the work done. So sometimes I'll do a rogue mentality, and it's been effective. But it's way more effective when my wife is doing the work. And the point I'm trying to make is that we fight on style. Like we'll argue over style on how to get things done with the kids. And it doesn't last more than a day, but it does affect the relationship. But I always go to bed saying to myself, that's not a bad argument. Like if we're fighting over like how the kids are going to write something and how much involvement I need not to be in, that's an all right argument. I'm cool with that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. So how did you guys meet? Because that's a question that we hear from a lot of single individuals. So where do you meet someone that you feel is compatible to you? So where did the two of you guys meet?
Shanti and I met at a restaurant here in St. Louis through some mutual friends. She had a good friend of ours introduce us like the day before Shanti was traveling to Africa. So on a Saturday night, she was like, come meet with my friend at this restaurant. And we hung out. And I immediately was like, that girl is awesome. Who is this kid? And so I was trying to, put my bid in. And there were other people there as well trying to put their bid in. Today she was going to Africa. Like she was leaving at like 2 p.m. to fly to Africa. And so, I didn't even get her number. But when she got back, I happened to catch her like 6 months to a year later in the mall. Ran into her, randomly, and got her information and picked up where I left off, trying to put my bid in. That was it. And we started dating. So that was how we met.
Yeah,
you might have a different perspective, though.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think and we had the same. St. Louis is small, so we had the same circle of friends. So we would run into each other at different social events. We knew the same group of people. So we were able to. And I think in today's day and age, where it's so hard to get to know people because we're all so busy. Sometimes a semi-arranged marriage, meaning, people who know that person and who can vouch for them and who know their history, sometimes that's not a bad thing. You can, it's like the what we call in anthropology, a fictive kinship. So back in the day when families would check out each other's spouses to make sure that that person's okay and doesn't have some stuff that they think would be negative, I think nowadays your group of close friends can serve as that to sort of let you know if that person's okay. So my female friends who are, extremely protective of each other, Jason would come around often before we were even really dating, but I guess he was courting me. I didn't know it at the time. And they were like, he likes you. We like him. So, the funny thing about Jason is he courted my family and friends first. And my older sister got to know him, and she's extremely picky. I'm not from here. They came here for Christmas. He brought a Christmas tree over. And my oldest sister, who's really a difficult judge of character, was like, and she found out his parents had been married for 43 years. She said, I really like him. My girlfriends were like, I like him. He's so attentive. He's such a good guy. And so his approach was clever. It worked. All the females surrounding me were like, oh, he's such a nice guy.
Yeah, and that's the public vetting process.
I want to kind of segue a little bit and jump back to something, which, by the way, I love that story. But I want to jump back because, Jason, you mentioned about, like, if there were one thing you guys argued about, it would be style and parenting sometimes. And I wanted to ask you guys, with everything going on right now with COVID-19 and schools are closed and, you know, and we're all kind of trying to figure out what this quarantine looks like. How have you guys dealt with that with the boys? And Jason and Julian are 12 and 10? What are they?
Exactly. Yep, 12, 10. So they're
okay.
Sixth and fourth grade.
Okay, so how have you guys dealt with talking to them about what's going on, like restructuring their time and what that looks like? And, you know, I would imagine you guys are having a lot more family time right now. So how is everybody, like, dealing with that? Because it's a new normal in a way.
Right, right. You know, it has brought the family closer. They're just off of spring break. So this Monday is when kind of school goes back in session, but it'll be administered from home. One, I think this, of course, the COVID-19 and communities that are being devastated by it and families, and my heart goes out to them and my heart goes out to, you know, the United States and other places around the world, Italy, Spain, China. But it has given all of us the time to slow down. We are a culture that is always on the go. We're a culture of feeling like we always have to be busy and we can't sit still. And I know we've taken the stay at home even before it became, you know, semi-mandated. We took it very seriously. And so we have been spending time at home with the family, watching Madam C.J. Walker. We watch that with the boys. Every night we watch a family kind of educational black series or mini series. We did art projects together. The boys are writing together. So starting tomorrow is when we're going to get on a better schedule with them and hopefully block out some time for them to do writing, reading, math. And then the schools, we're fortunate because we live in a school district where the teachers are going to still do online teaching. So they'll have that. But I personally feel like it's brought the family together. We've eaten in since, you know, for the last 2 weeks. We've eaten together. In some ways, I think it's given all of us a chance to get to know our partners better, our kids better, and learn to deal with conflict and how are we going to live in our spaces as a family.
Yeah, I think it's been it's been good. We're pretty direct with the kids when it comes to like COVID or even racism or, you know, all the issues that will impact your ability to navigate as a black person in this community. We're pretty direct with the kids. We have very honest and direct conversations. And, you know, along with that, coupled with that, we also have kind of a curriculum already that exists in the household, which is, you know, your homework has to be done before you do anything else. And we've been writing with these guys for such a long time. I mean, since like, I want to say since Julian, the youngest, was in third grade and the oldest was in fifth, they've been on this writing curriculum. You know, I've been on this binge about being good writers and being good communicators. So being in the house right now, experiencing COVID and being in close quarters for like this period of time really hasn't been much of an adjustment. You know, so yeah, we've been just, you know, making it happen. They're used to this.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's
you
a
guys,
great
one of the...
teaching experience.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, and again, it's an unfortunate situation of what's going on now, but this has also allowed us to teach them about epidemics and about government decisions and about inequalities and how the already poor and disenfranchised are going to be impacted, you know, at a more severe long-term impact, washing their hands, cleanliness. So, you know, it's been a really interesting teaching moment.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you both have taken the last couple of weeks as the perspective on that it's a learning, that you guys are seeing this as a learning opportunity for not only you all as a couple, but the entire family. And so I'm hoping that our listeners are able to hear that because I am still seeing clients online now. And the minute the school systems said that they were going to be closing an additional week after spring break, my clients were in a frantic for some of them because they were just like,
yeah.
What am I doing with my kid? Like, what's going to happen? And, you know, I got to keep this kid all day long. And I'm like, this is your child. Yes, you have to keep them all day long. And so the idea that, yes, everyone is going to have to create this new normal is part of it, but having parents see it from, okay, this is now a teaching opportunity. What can I do to teach my child about the epidemic, about, you know, how those that are disenfranchised are probably going to be hit the worst, and, you know, teach gratitude. And so I'm glad that I was able to hear that from you guys because a lot of the parents that I have been talking to are just like, I don't know what this is, what I'm going to do with my child. And they're really looking for the school system to kind of create something for their kids while they're out for the next week or two or however long this happens. And so I'm reminding them about the summer slope that happens, and they want to avoid that from happening. And so to kind of keep them engaged. But obviously that's more work on the part of the parent. But that seems like something that you guys are already engaging in right now. And so thank you for sharing that. Because people are like, what does it look like? How do you do it?
Right.
I think you guys just gave really good examples of that. We do have a question from one of our listeners. Let me go back to it. So the question is, how do you all resolve disagreements that you may have?
Good question.
You know, I think, so usually we're pretty reflective on the conversation, on the argument. I mean, I'm just saying, first, I think Shanti and I aren't, we're level-headed. And we want what we want, of course, both of us. But we're level-headed. And it's not that one is always right about something, but, you know, it's like it just you got to trust the other person. And so we don't ever resolve, like, not always resolve. Like yesterday, for example, the conversation was a few days before was, like, we got to be very my thing was we got to be very careful about when we go outside. Like, I don't want any of their friends over here. I don't want them going outside and hanging out with their friends in any way because I don't want them bringing that virus back into the house. And then when we do go outside, we got to wear, you know, protective gear, like our masks and our gloves. Then I came in the house the other day, and Shanti was like, you know, you need to take off your clothes and put them in the dryer when you come in the house. And then I didn't want to do it. And she was like, you want us to do what you want to do, and you got to do what I want you to do. And I was like, all right, I just did it. And then, you know, we just let it, I let it go and I apologized and we kept it moving. So that's kind of how it worked. And it wasn't like a direct apology. Like, hey, I apologize for making the mistake. It was more like we did our normal routine. We cracked some jokes, some really random, silly jokes. And then we just, you know, get back cool with each other. that's kind of how it works. So that's kind of how we solve our problems. But I mean, our main focus is, our relationship and our kids. And we haven't, I don't think I have at least, I haven't done a lot of dumb things, to make her not want to trust me, and vice versa. So that kind of helps the relationship out. It kind of helps the conversation out. But I think if I'm out here making really bad, poor decisions, putting our relationship in jeopardy, you know, then I, and vice versa, I think then there's going to be a tougher time trying to resolve our conflicts.
Yeah, arguments, I mean, disagreements are, I think it's difficult for any couple. I think we all know the textbook about how you're supposed to deal with disagreements, and all of us get it wrong. I think Jason and I just kind of take a step back, go into our, because both of us, opinions, you know, I always think, to, I always jokingly say, a lot of women I know have kind of, their husbands have been trained to just say, okay. And I'm still waiting for Jason to learn how to just say okay. And I realized I married him because I married him because he's strong, he has opinions, and I have to admit he'll never just be the type of husband to say okay, even if I want.
Uh-huh.
So I think both of us have just learned to, you know, air our grievances, say our point, and then just sort of let it alone. And that it, we might not ever agree. We just have to kind of agree to disagree about something and not let it get in the way of our relationship and a future decision. Jason certainly did not, he still thinks me saying take off your clothes because he works in a public place. And I'm like, take them off, put them in the dryer, even if there's no evidence that Corona's on them. Who knows? We'll do the first study that this is. What do you know? So I think it's really just moving on. But I do think, you know, I do think, and this might piss some listeners off, but I do, I'm a strong black woman, but I do, and society is certainly hard on black women. I think society really tries hard historically to emasculate black men. And as a black woman married to a black man, I think I always have to keep that in mind, and I always have to support him and lift him up. And when he's out there and society's, you know, he's running a business, he's doing what he's doing, you know, I have to make sure that I support him and I don't tear him down like I think society, both through guns and through other things and through the prison system and depictions on TV, they've really made it difficult for black men. And I think it's part of white supremacy is to tear down black men. It is, again, it is hard on black women. I mean, don't get me wrong. But, you know, we're already at the bottom. They already don't see us as a threat. So I think that's also part of it, is really supporting each other as gendered beings in the world. And Jason's aware of the sexism that I have to face as a black woman. So I think that really helps, knowing that no matter what kind of disagreements we have, that ultimately we support each other and the larger struggles that we all are facing.
Yeah, one of the things that I just heard you guys mention is the idea behind supporting each other, and both of you guys being mindful that when you leave the house, you're both going to experience something very different, but it is going to be a challenge. And so when you come home, you're looking for your mate to be able to provide you with that support. Because even though as a black woman, you know that your challenges don't look like your husband, and your husband realizes that his challenges doesn't look like your challenges as a black woman, but you both are still supporting each other. And however, you know, that looks when you come back home with each other. And that seems to be one of the challenges that we experience in the African-American culture specifically, is that because we're both dealing with so many challenges, we don't often see our mate as our support system. They become the people that are also attacking. And so I'm glad that you guys made reference to that. And then, Jason, I just want to say this. You're probably not going to like it, but when you're asked to take your clothes off and put them in the dryer, that makes a whole lot of sense, because Dr. Gupta, who's been probably on everyone's news channel talking about the coronavirus, someone posed a question to him and said, hey, should I be using my clothes to grab doorknobs and handles and all those things? Is it better to just use my clothes to wipe them down? And Dr. Gupta said, no, it's not better to use your clothes because the virus can still live on your clothes. And so it's best to either grab it, you know, a handle with a tissue or gloves or whatever that may have been. But when he said that, it really struck me that, oh, yeah, this virus can live on items like, you know, tables and doorknobs, but we now know that it can also live on our clothes. So it's probably a good idea that you're dropping your clothes off in the dryer when you come in the house.
Absolutely. No, so, yeah, that's, I'm not mad about that.
He got over it.
Yeah.
He vented. Oh, yeah. He ranted and raved. I let him, you know, kind of unleash on me, and then I was like, okay, well, that's that.
Yeah.
I do think in terms of conflict, sometimes our partners just need to vent. And sometimes, you know, it's very hard, but I think sometimes we don't need to get defensive and we just need to let the person say what they have to say. There doesn't have to be a response. And we just need to practice what we tell our kids, which is, you know, be the bigger person and just let it go. You don't have to have the last word.
Yeah, I'm sure the one thing about that point that Shanti's making is, yeah, you don't know that. There's no way in the world you're going to know that in year one of your marriage. Like, this is really you don't really realize that type of stuff until you get past, like, certain stages. And I can't even identify the stages. I can't say, oh, this is the stage where you start to realize, or when it gets good, or when this happens. But, I mean, yeah, it's you know, it takes time to actually get to that point where you're, like, you know, able to let your partner vent, and it doesn't affect the relationship like that. Like, because they're not, you know, it's a respectful thing. It's not, they're not cursing you out. They're just upset, or they're frustrated, or they don't feel like doing that extra step.
Or they might curse.
Yeah, but well, you're not cursing me out, though.
No, not.
I'm not cursing you out. No. But I will use expletives, and she will too, to make sure she knows I understand her point. You know what I'm saying? And some people get offended. In year one, and year two, you might get offended by that. Year 14, you're like, nah, that's not offensive. Actually, that was kind of cathartic. So
interesting. You guys, we do have another question from one of our listeners, and he says, how can you both give family commitments to each other and your full attention while both of you all are working demanding while both of you all have demanding careers?
You want to go first?
I have to say it's tough, man. It is tough. But, I mean, we also cut a lot of our extracurricular activities out that we used to do. Like, I used to go out at least two or three times a week with a buddy of mine who was in the coffee business. And we would eat and drink wine. That was our thing. Like, we went out and sipped wine. We bought some really good wines. And then we would eat really, really good food. And we'd try to, like, you know, just have a good time chatting. But that's out the window, you know. That's out the window after the first 2-3 years of marriage. And then you start to really focus on, like, what's the most important, once again, which is your kid. I mean, I want the product of my kid, the outcome, to be the, you know, resemble the kind of work we put in on them. And so Shanti and I mean, like, literally, like that's our focus. I mean, now we too are our focus as well, our relationship. But I mean, our focus is our kids. I mean, that's our legacy. And that kind of helps me just get back to center. I don't need a man's cave. I'm not into going out smoking cigars with my buddies and flying around. I don't need to see a bunch of chicks in different cities. That's just not my thing. I mean, that's just not where I'm at. I think my focus is, and this is where Shanti align on what we want in life. Like, I really want to be like a person who was a change agent and had true impact on my community, and really sort of African American men and women. And others came behind me, and were able to persevere and get to the top. Like, I would be so satisfied if that's the outcome based on my impact on community. And so Shanti and I, we have that same belief in some capacity. We have the same exact belief.
Yeah.
So I'm cool with, I mean, that's what we focus on. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I get more out of that. I get more out of people calling me and saying, oh, man, you put me on in this certain situation, this connection. Like, it really worked out for me. I appreciate the love. Thank you very much. And I'm like, that makes me feel better than hitting the licks I'm looking for. You know, it's always good to have people benefit from your cachet, your, you know, social capital or whatever you did to put them in a position to get that win that they needed to get to the next level. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what's up, man. Like being on the school board. And I'm on the school board here in Clayton because I want these black kids to succeed, and I want these white folks who, a lot of them are great people and are progressive and all that, but when you get in your silos, you can easily get back to like what you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing is, I want these white folks to know that you, even at the crib when you sleep, you got to be thinking about how it's gonna be, where there's gonna be equality and equity and how my white child is gonna work with these black kids and learn from these black kids and be better stewards when they get old enough to start making their own decisions. So, like, that's the kind of impact I want to have. So that makes it easy for us, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, I agree. It's I think to the question of how do you balance, your question was how do you balance both? Or could you repeat the question?
Yeah. Sure. He said, let me go back up to it. How can you give commitments? How can you give family commitments to each other and your full attention while both of you are working in your demanding careers?
Yeah. I think it's hard. I always, at work in a lot of sort of young female professional organizations or African-American organizations asked me to speak on that topic of balancing family, personal life, and work life. And I always jokingly say that I feel like I don't do any of it as well as I would like to, but I to do it, the mixture as best as I can for right now. So having young children, trying to run a household, having a demanding career, it's definitely a lot. And I think Jason and I, as Jason said, we both had to sit down and prioritize what are the extracurricular things that are meaningful to us. And as you said, for both of us, it's social justice issues, it's equality issues. For me, it's, you know, women's reproductive health, it's HIV. And so everything we do tends to be focused around that. Work is demanding, working at the university and having to publish and supervise students. I remember when we first got married, I was so used to, before we got married, staying at the office sometimes until 10 o'clock at night. In our first year of marriage, before we had kids, I would do it. And Jason called me one day, and I was in the office. I don't know if he remembers this, but he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm at the office. He said, you know, you have a family now. You have to tell me where you are and what time you're coming home. I'm worried about you. And I remember at that point, I realized, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm now accountable to my new family. And Jason sometimes gets home before I do so that he can start working with the kids. I feel very guilty. I'm still on, boards. I tried to scale back, but spending time in the evenings going to board meetings is time away from my kids. Jason's mom, both of my parents passed before our kids were born, but Jason's mom said, you don't have to stop all of your extra activities because that's showing your boys a good role model. It's showing them values. It's showing them that we're, as black people, we have a responsibility and an obligation to our community, and for whom much is given, much is expected. But we try to share with our kids what we're doing, so it also becomes a learning opportunity. But I, till this day, after 14 years of marriage, still find it
really demanding to juggle it all and to still take care of yourself. You have to still try to go to the gym, eat healthy. It's a lot. And you always have to be committed to it and just always be mindful of it. And if you slip on one of them and you don't spend enough time, there's always tomorrow. So I think also forgiving yourself.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, yeah. And we also take little jabs at each other and, like, little reminder jabs. Like, if I come home late or if I'm going out for a business meeting or something, like, on Saturday morning I'll get up early. I'll leave the house like 6:30, and she'll be like, "Oh, are you? What time are you coming back?" And I know what's happening, and I'll say
in a few minutes.
I'll be back in a little while, like real soon. She's like, and then just say something like, "Well, I'll just have someone else take the kids to XYZ," and she knows I hate that. So it's a reminder that our obligation is home, kids, family.
Uh-huh.
Just reminder, don't be out all day, and not trying to police each other, but just trying to remind each other, like, we need to see each other, we need to hang around each other, so don't make it an all day thing. So, because it's easy for us to get caught up in our work, easy.
What would you guys? Because hearing you guys describe kind of how you create that balance. Sounds like that there are some times where you feel like I'm doing a really good job, and then there are other times where I may have missed the ball, and I just agreed next time that I'm going to do better, or I'm going to work better at, potentially not dropping the ball next time. What would you two say to a couple who maybe one resents the other because they feel like they're always picking up the slack because the other person is pursuing the career because that's what's necessary at that particular time for them? So what would you say to someone who's dealing with maybe that in their relationship to not create these feelings of resentment because your spouse is doing their best to try to improve the family versus, no, I'm angry because you're never here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like I know extremely common. That's a hard one to deal with because I think, of course, the best advice is communicate with your partner, but then your partner, it could lead to defensiveness because the person who feels like they are doing more in one area, it's probably, they're hurt and it's probably a very difficult thing for them to mention to the other person in a loving way, in a way that is productive. I think coming up with a schedule, I don't know, because I really do feel like I feel like that right there is an issue that I hear a lot of married couples dealing with, is one does feel like they're doing more of this than the other. And how do they get the other person involved? Open lines of communication, or maybe even knowing that what's our bottom goal? If our goal is that with the kids, what are some routes to getting there? So maybe starting with the end in mind is a strategy. I think that Jason and I, we don't articulate it that way, but we always think the end product is making sure that we're doing right by our children and for our relationship. And then maybe coming up with a plan that way. But, I know we try to share the burden of what's going on, but that is a tough one.
Yeah, I don't – in a situation like that where, like, one is resenting the other or one's feels like they're putting in more work than the other, like, I don't know. I don't think – that's kind of foreign to us because I think we are putting in the work. I'm definitely not holding Shanti back. Like, I'm marrying Shanti off the rip. Shanti let me know she managed the expectations up front about who she was. And the good thing for me is I didn't have those misogynistic men kind of, beliefs about women, like you're supposed to cook for me, he's supposed to be home for me. Like, that's not my thing, because I didn't come from that household. My mother, like Shanti, was the steady breadwinner in the household. Like, she had the job, she was a principal, and my dad was out there hustling, trying to make it happen. And so I grew up in that position where, like, you know, my dad wasn't going to tell my mom not to do something. And my mom wasn't telling my dad, as an African-American male trying to make it out here with a bunch of ideas and he's a creative guy, to not go do what he needs to do that's going to provide him the sanity and be able to put food on the table. And I think Shanti and I have that same mentality. So it's kind of hard for us to give advice to somebody, you know, because I'm immediately going to go to what I know, which is, man, you shouldn't have married that person. You know what I'm saying? Like, you knew going in what kind of person that was.
Yeah.
So my advice would be you need to divorce that person.
No.
but that's why I wouldn't want to give that kind of advice, because I'm just kind of like, you know, you need to know up front what it is you want, what your non-negotiables are, and what it is the person that you're dealing with, what they want and what their non-negotiables are. And from there, just manage the expectations that if you can't do it, although they may look great, although they may, you know, make you feel good in certain ways, like, it ain't enough for that long-term commitment to last.
You know, I know for me, one of the things I hear a lot is transporting the kids. And one partner typically feels like they're the one doing it more. And in that situation, I think, you know, I always just ask Jason, you know, Jason, can you take the kids there? And he usually does it. But then I think sometimes we just have to shift how we think about it. I mean, I do most of the cooking at home, but not because Jason doesn't cook or not because I'm a woman, but because I don't want to spend money eating out. And so Jason, if it's time to eat, will be like, okay, let's go to the restaurant and get a burger. And I'm cheap. I'm like, I want to eat at home, so I'll be the one to cook. And that's just important to me, and I want my boys to have a healthy meal. I think at first I was like, what's going on? Why doesn't he cook? And eventually I'm like, you know what, if it's important to me that everybody has a home-cooked meal, I'm going to do it and just not complain. And then Jason makes great chili. And so I'll say, okay, chili time, you know, okay, chili, okay, Jason, time to make chili. But I think over time we just have to realize that our partners aren't going to always do everything we think they should be doing. And half the time I don't do everything I think I should be doing. So I think sometimes we just have to cut each other some slack.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to, cutting slack.
Can you see why I am a fangirl of this couple? Like, are they not fantastic?
Like,
I want to ask you guys.
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead,
Sima. Okay, I want to ask you guys a question. One of the things that, you know, it seems that you both are really focused on is, like, you know, raising the boys and, you know, to be really solid and productive stewards of their community and to give back and to be, you know, grateful. But I wanted to ask you, how do you turn toward one another? Because so often I talk with couples and women in particular in therapy, and they'll say, you know, I made my kids my focus. I made my kids my happiness. And then when the kids are gone, they look at each other and it's like, you know, we're strangers because the focus was so on the children that they forgot to invest in their intimate relationship. And by intimacy, I'm not just talking about sex. So, you know, I'm just talking about the way that we turn to one another and connect with one another. And so I'm wondering, how do you guys create space for that?
That's a good question.
Yeah, good.
I mean, that's all that is. Like you said, it's 24 hours in a day. and it takes, you got to have, emotional strength to be able to have that kind of a conversation with your wife or a spouse or partner about things that are going on in your world that require, you before you have that conversation, you put enough into the intimacy bank to have it. So, yeah, I mean, it's tough because like, 24 hours in a day, and you might not have gotten it in the last couple of days, put that work in, that investment in. But, like, the main thing is knowing that you can be vulnerable with that person at any time. And you also may not get the immediate feedback you're looking for. And you might storm off like, hey, you didn't even listen to me, shit. But they are listening, or it may come back around to you later on. I mean, you just kind of gotta be patient with that process.
Yeah.
I think sometimes I'm not listening. Sometimes Shanti will wake up in the middle of the night, and she'll say, "Are you awake?" And I'm asleep, and I'm like, but then I gotta listen. You know what I'm saying? I'll be in tune to listen, and then she'll fall asleep on me, and then I'm up listening to something, and she's asleep. Now I'm up. Now that's part of the game, but it's just like you just gotta take it where you can get it nowadays. You know what I'm saying? That's how I look at it. I hope that answers your question. But
yeah. No, I think you're right. I think sometimes the project of child rearing takes priority over the project of the marriage. And that can certainly be an easy thing to do because the joint project of children, it seems like in some ways it's an easier one. I do feel like Jason and I share so much when it comes to our views on politics, on social justice, on equality, on racial equality, that so much of what we do tends to revolve around conversations around that, sharing news with each other. Jason will call me, run ideas by me. I tell him what's going on at work. One thing we don't do that people always, when we first got married, people would say, make sure you have date night. And I have to say, I don't think we have date night very much. We don't have a planned date night. We know some couples that every Friday is their date night or every other Friday. I don't know if we've ever gotten into, have we ever, we go on dates, but not really date night. Maybe once in a while.
We go to a lot of
events,
like nonprofit chicken dinners. and so those to me are date nights. That's date night because we go out and get a go do our thing at the do our 1-2 at the spot, and then we'll slide off to the restaurant, maybe get some drinks, and go home.
Yeah.
But I mean,
even that I've had to compromise. I used to go to a lot of them, and Jason would be like, Jason didn't want to go after a while. And I was like, okay, if he doesn't want to do something, whether it's go shopping with me on Saturday for groceries or going to those chicken dinners, Jason would say, well, that's just not fun for me. And over time, do you remember that?
Yeah.
And over time, I was like, okay, I guess I just got to go solo and let him, do things together that are exciting for both of us. But if it's not exciting for him, I can't nag him. I can't take it personally. And we'll do things together that we find fun and interesting.
I do want to say that Shanti and I have a real strong belief in social justice. Like, really rooted in black politics. Like, really rooted in that. And I think that's what keeps us together on many levels. Like, that's some really strong bonding glue. Because we're always talking about, like, just how hard it is. Like we're in a – Clayton is a white – the wealthiest white community in Missouri. And as the first African-American, elected official on the school board, it's tough out here, man. My goal is to raise my black kids like as African American men who are aware of anti-blackness and who aren't what's the word I'm looking for? their blackness isn't commandeered by white culture, right?
Mm,
so I want my little dudes to be black in a white space, and be cool with it. Like they can still have their white friends, but they're checking those black those white kids if they say something that could be borderline offensive, and it's okay for them to be around the white friends and have a black girlfriend, and just, you know, just aware of blackness, just aware of being black in that space. Not that it's going to prevent you from getting ahead, but so that these other kids can learn that it's, oh, I have this cool black friend, and Jason and Julian, like, they're cool. You know, those kids taught me a lot. They're my long-term friends. You know what I'm saying? Because they were black. They didn't get around white kids and start acting like they come from that culture, come from that community. You know what I'm saying? Like, they come from a different... I want them to be who they are in that space.
Uh-huh.
And remembering their history, knowing their stuff. So that's the one thing, one of the many things, but a very major item that holds Shanti and our attention together and holds us together. So that's just something that I want to emphasize. Like, that's just where we are on that, you know?
So Jason, absolutely. I wanted to ask you, because I'm looking at the time tick down, and I'd be remiss if I didn't get a chance to ask you, how, we talked about you being, you know, in Missouri and even in the country, you know, only in Missouri in the country, one of a few black coffee roasting company owners. How did you get into that? And then, you know, there as a black man, a small business owner, you know, how does that work in terms of, like, managing to keep Northwest successful, but also, you know, just the struggles that comes with being a small business owner and not letting that bleed into frustrations at home?
Well, I have to say this. So I was in business school at the time when I got into the coffee industry. So I was at Washington University. I owned another company during another recession, 07, 08. I was winding down that business, trying to sell off a few things. And when I got into business school, went to China and started realizing how globalized the idea of coffee is, like this coffee culture. And I was like, why don't we have coffee shops in like predominantly black communities? And so that was my goal. I came back to St. Louis and from being in China for this business school trip that we took from WashU after a month and put a business plan together. It took me some time, wound down my other business while going through the recession, watching, you know, this cold credit default swap process take place in 08. And then finally in 2010, I connected with my best friend's father. His name was David Price. That's the father, my best friend, Jason Price. I showed him the business plan. And for 2 years, I just put this idea together of wanting to put coffee shops throughout the inner city and predominantly black communities. And so I just started putting it together and we raised a few dollars. Most of it was our own money. And we opened up our first coffee shop in North St. Louis City in an old project housing space. And then I bought Northwest Coffee because it was the best coffee in St. Louis. And I wanted to be vertical and roast the coffee and let people know this is really black owned. We're vertical. We can produce. We can do a lot of good stuff here. And that's how I got into the business. But you don't know it until you're in it. Like, damn, it sucks being the only black dude in the game. And being black is almost, it really is a strike against you in this space. Like, you know, even black people are going to look at me, and they still do to this day. They'll say, oh, you roast coffee, man? Wait, you roast? And they'll say, man, is it good? Like, come on, man. Like, of course it's good. So you always you always get that. You always get black folks are always going to be when you're an entrepreneur. That is, you're always going to get that discount. Always, it's like someone's always going to discount you off the top. And it just hurts worse though when black folks do it because you always, you know, you have this false narrative in your mind that black folks are going to support black folks, and it's never been historically ever where that's ever even happened. I don't know why we don't get out of our mind, but you know, it's like you have this in the back of your mind, like black folks are going to support black folks, but that's not how we operate. And so that's where I am now. What was the other part of your question? It was
when there are frustrations, like how do manage? Yeah,
you know what? So number one, I don't do a great job of managing it all the time because sometimes, like, I come home and I'm on edge. Like, I'm trying to help the kids out, and like my youngest or my oldest might give me hell, and I might take it out on them. But what I also do is I also try to beat it to the punch, right? So I'm come home frustrated, and I'll try to talk with them about what the ills of being black or the ills of being in business as African American, and why it's important to, like, you know, really be great writers and really be able to communicate effectively and to have game, right? To perfect your conversation, perfect your, you know, have a lot of experiences so that you can have a lot of game when you're talking to people. And so I do, that's what I do a lot. I'm always trying to just give them a lot of information about, you know, what happened to me that day. It always comes in the form of a jewel, what pitfalls you need to stay out of. But that's the only way I can really deal with it. And then having a wife that understands that, you know, I'm out here in a space, you know, I manufacture a product, and there aren't that many, very few black folks in America that manufacture a product that compete with white folks' products.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't name a lot. Successful. I mean, if you can, let me know. If anybody can do it, email or, you know, Facebook me. I mean, I just know that it's very hard being black and being a manufacturer of a product. I'm not talking about being an entrepreneur who's a doctor, an entrepreneur who owns his own practice or franchise the business. I'm talking about you started something and you're competing out here in the game and you got quality product, but you can't get enough black folks to come in, and white folks are skeptical because, you know, people do business with people who they like and who look like them. That's just kind of how we operate. And so it's just tough being in that space. And so I'm always reminding my boys of that. I'm also telling them that at the same time, I want you to try, but I also want you to be very, very, you know, aware of the kind of gross negligence that happens when black folks are told, you can do anything you want to do. I mean, you can, but let's just keep it real. Like, there are some limitations, and the odds are against you, and it's not just about a perfect plan. You can be the dopest person who went to business school. I got some friends who went to Harvard business school, went to Yale, I mean, who went to, like, MIT, and they're just not cutting it. You know what I'm saying? Like, they had to stop what they were doing in the entrepreneurial world and go work for somebody. That's just kind of how it went. So it's very hard.
You guys, I have been so enriched by having this conversation with the two of you all today. Years ago, I can say, when people actually watched The Cosby Show, that was the model of what a black family could look like. And I remember watching it as a kid and thinking, oh, I'm going to be the Cosbys one day. And hearing my classmates at the time say, this isn't real. Black people don't live like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so offended because these were students that looked like me that didn't believe that you could have a two-parent home where both couples, both parties were working and raised kids. And even then, I talked about my parents. They were together then. They were together now. And so I just felt like I was outside of that norm even back then. But today we don't hear a lot of couples that talk about Black powerhouse couples. And we know they exist, mm-hmm. but we don't shine the light on them. We kind of talk about the negative side of relationships. And when most of the time when people are talking about people in relationships, it's because they did something they weren't supposed to be doing. And so I am so glad that we had an opportunity over this last hour or so to really highlight a couple that we can truly say is a powerhouse couple. Now, obviously, we're not saying that any couple is perfect and that every relationship has its ebb and flow, but for the last 14 years, you guys have been able to make it work. And we know that there have been some challenges, and despite those challenges, you all continue to raise your kids, you continue to nurture your relationships, and you continue to make a mark in the industries that you're working in. And so I thank you for taking time out of your day on a Sunday, because this is probably family time that you guys have given us. I so greatly appreciate it. But before we go, I would like for you all to tell all of our listeners how they can get your coffee if they're in Missouri, where you guys are located, if they're a Facebook page, a website. Please let our listeners know how they can visit you all, being that you all are the only African-Americans that are doing it in your area and just in any other state. Go ahead and take a moment to tell that to our listeners if you can.
Yep. So you can visit Northwest Coffee online at www.northwestcoffee.com. You can go to our Facebook page, which is Northwest Coffee, our Instagram page, which is Northwest Coffee Co., as in company, Northwest Coffee Co., Twitter page, Northwest Coffee as well. And, just hit us up, and we'll send you some coffee. I mean, we have an online
merchant.
And if you're in St. Louis or in Missouri, you can go to 4251 Laclede Avenue.
Which is in the Central West End.
Central West End, Missouri. And you can come there and watch us roast, get some fresh espresso or fresh coffee, and eat some good food in our really amazing space that we have. And, hang out and then go home and enjoy it at home. Yep.
Yeah. And it's important that we support Black businesses, because banks don't do it enough, as Jason mm-hmm. said, Black residents don't do it enough. So, and it's great coffee. Mm-hmm. It's won awards.
Yep.
Thank you guys so much. I hope that I will have an opportunity to bring both of you guys back on some later shows. I'm so interested to pick you all's brains on some different topics. And I cannot leave without saying the same thing about support Black businesses. I think we sometimes have a misconception that Black businesses don't live up to our standards, and so we'll go spend our money someplace else because we've gotten bad service from another Black business owner. But we can't make that assumption about all Black business owners. So whenever you can, please, please support Black businesses. I know I say that all the time because I'm a Black business owner and I want you to support me, but I definitely want you to support people that look like us, because we're out there and we're providing great services that you all are paying, someone else for. And so with that being said, Steve, you've been kind of quiet on today's show. Did you get hit by COVID-19?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I've just been sitting back and enjoying the company. I think it's very, very encouraging, to hear people solve their problems without needing a magic eight ball or anything like that. So, I've been really encouraged to hear the couple and their journey. It sounds real, real positive. This gentleman's out slaying dragons, and he doesn't have to come home to face another dragon when he walks in the door. So I've been encouraged, and like what I've heard.
I never know what you're thinking.
My wife's a dragon slayer too, man. Like beast mode, man. So.
And I want to say
definitely to support each other. That's wonderful.
Buy Jason's coffee, but there's also a movement in academia called Fight Black Women. So if anybody out there is in academia, please buy my books. They're on Amazon. One of them is
Dr. Patrick, I'm going to bring you back on so you can specifically talk about that, so we can spend some more time, because I am in academia, and so I am sure that is something that I want to find out more about, and our listeners, I want them to get that information too. So where can they find the book?
It's on both of them are on Amazon. Okay. So they're by Vanderbilt University Press. And what the most recent one is called Regulating Romance, Youth Love Letters, Moral Anxiety, and Intervention in Uganda's Time of AIDS. And just like black businesses, there's, and then you know this as well, there's evidence to show that black women are cited a lot less, even though our work is referred to. We get less credit for it.
Absolutely.
And you said the movement is Cite Black Women, C-I-T-E.
I-T-E.
Yes, Cite Black Women. Yep.
Got it.
Okay. All right. Fatima, do you have any closing words before we leave?
Closing words. You know, I have said before, and I'll say again, there's no such thing as a perfect relationship. What is perfect is what works for the couple. And I think that this is one couple who found a way to make perfect for themselves and what works for their family. I just really want to echo what Dr. Guy said, and thank you both for coming on the show. I mean, I don't want to gush. I love them so much. And quick story, when I was in St. Louis and having, like, you know, my horrible dating life, and I used to, like, I would sometimes be hanging out with around them, and I'm like, oh, you know, I want a guy that has this and that and this and that. And Shanti so politely one day was like, you know, I didn't go looking for a Jason. Like, I wasn't specifically looking for somebody who had these specific things. And I always took that away. Like, I took that with me. That was very meaningful to me. And so I guess in closing, I would say, as fabulous as these people are, right, I think that we can appreciate a Shanti and a Jason, but also be open to finding our own Shanti, like the person who is the Shanti or the Jason for us.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I agree with that, Fatima. And so that's going to be my new hashtag for today. And that hashtag is Black Love Can Work. So thank you, Fatima. Thank you guys for joining me. Steve, as always, thank you for joining us another Sunday. You guys, don't forget to Facebook it, tweet it, pass it on, tell a friend about Dr. Guy's Gumbo Talk. Everyone be safe, be blessed, and don't forget to tune in next Sunday. Thank you guys again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Be blessed.